So would you open up with me to Exodus chapter 3, verse 7 through 8. This is the word of the Lord. The Lord said, I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I am concerned about their suffering. So I have come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey. All right, so what is Passover about? Maybe you've seen The Prince of Egypt, right? One of the all-time great classics. What is Passover about? Passover reminds us that our God is a God who sees us and a God who hears us, right? He heard the groans of his people and he responded. And not only that, he longs to deliver us from all the things that are holding us back from the life that he has called us to live, the life that he has intended us for us to live. Now, the question is, why is it called Passover? If you guys know the story in Exodus, the Israelites, they're enslaved by Egypt. They're made to do forced labor, hard labor, and they're crying out to God to free them. And so the people cry out, God, would you deliver us? But Pharaoh's heart, it says it's hardened, and he refuses to let the people go. So God, in response to Pharaoh's hardened heart, he sends the Egyptians 10 plagues. And the 10th and final plague is the one that finally causes Pharaoh's heart to relent and to release the people. And that 10th plague was the death of the firstborn. And so in Exodus 12, the angel of the Lord goes throughout Egypt and strikes down the firstborn in every household. But the Israelites are told, hey, if you smear the blood of a lamb on the doorposts of your house, then the angel of death will pass you over, which is where the name Passover comes from. So God tells them on that day, here's what you're to do. Choose an unblemished lamb, a lamb that's pure, and I want you to sacrifice it and drain it of its blood. I want you to take a bunch of hyssop leaves and dip it in the blood, and I want you to paint over the doorposts of your house. And when you do that, death will pass over you and your loved ones. Now, here's a question. Why only put blood on the doorposts? Right? Like logically thinking, I'm thinking, okay, if an angel of death is coming into my town, into my neighborhood, I'm painting every surface area available, right? I'm painting the whole door. Why just the doorpost? Why not the most surface area that I possibly could? Why? So the angel can't miss it. Why just the doorpost? The thing we have to understand is as slaves, the Israelites, they knew all about everything in Egypt. They built everything in Egypt, every building, every house, everything from Pharaoh's palace all the way to the very small huts that they lived in. And so they knew the architecture of their own home. And what's interesting about the huts that they lived in Egypt is that even though most of the house was made of mud and clay, the doorposts were actually made of stone, right? If there was ever a natural disaster or like heavy rain, right, the mud and clay would usually get washed away, but the only thing that was left standing was a stone doorpost. And so you see it all throughout Egyptian architecture. You'll see that within every building, they have these huge stone archways. And then within the archways, actually, there are names inscribed on them. And so you'll see a stone archway as a door for every building, every architecture, and you'll see that names are inscribed within that stone. And it was their symbolic way of saying that even if everything fades away, even if everything is demolished, as long as they believe in their gods, they would remain standing just like these stones that are left standing. Like in the ancient world, your name was more than just something that you gave to your barista at Starbucks, right? Your name actually was a part of who you were. It conveyed your identity and your essence. And they would say that if your name was not inscribed on something that would stand the test of time, you hear me? If your name was not inscribed on something permanent, that you too would eventually fade away in the afterlife. So listen, if you're writing your name on, I don't know, like you took a ceramics class, right? And you made a beautiful cup. Everyone does that these days. And you described your name on that. The moment that broke in this lifetime, you would fade away in the afterlife, right? But if you wrote your name on something permanent, you would live forever. That's what they believed. And so basically, if you wanted to live for all eternity, if you wanted to bypass death, they said you would better inscribe your name on one of those stone archways so that your name would not fade away. So what happens? God tells them to sacrifice a lamb and paint over the doorposts. Right, what's he really saying? What's going on here? He's saying the blood of the lamb painted over the names of the people is what's going to bring life. It's what's going to cause death to pass you over. It was their way of saying, Only God will save us. Not these stones, not these foreign empires, not these other gods. Only the blood of the Lamb will ensure that death passes over me. Only the blood of the Lamb will ensure that my name is written in the book of life for all of eternity. Only the blood of the Lamb will ensure that I live forever. You see, Passover was not just about escaping death or preserving life. It was about destroying idolatry. Right? It was their way of saying, I'm letting go of my trust in all other gods. I'm letting go of my trust even in myself, and I'm placing my wholehearted trust in you, God. And so God says, in order for death to pass you over, in order for you to have this life, something has to die on your behalf. Something has to die in your place. He's saying blood has to cover your name. Do you see the symbolism there? And so the most important element of the Passover story, it's not like the parted seas, right? It's not like that movie, that scene was so epic in The Prince of Egypt. Do you guys remember? That's not the heart of the Passover story. The heart, the centerpiece of the Passover story is that lamb that was sacrificed for you. That lamb whose blood was shed so death would pass you over. That lamb is the centerpiece of Passover. And so ever since the Exodus, the Passover lamb has actually become this beautiful divine hint all throughout Scripture, a prophetic symbol of the Lamb to come, a prophetic sign of the Messiah that they're anticipating. Right, let's look to Isaiah, one of the Old Testament prophets, Isaiah 53, 6 through 7. This is what the prophet Isaiah says. He says, we all, like sheep, have gone astray. Each of us has turned to our own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed and afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. He was led like a what? Like a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before its shearers is silent, so he did not open his mouth. All throughout the Old Testament, there are these divine hints that God is going to deliver his people from all the oppressive empires of the world, and he's going to deliver them from even death itself. And the way that he would do that is through a Messiah who looked a lot like a lamb. Let's go to the New Testament. These are in John 1:29, before John baptizes Jesus. It says, the next day, John saw Jesus coming toward him and said, look, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. You see, even in the New Testament, it's clear that this God of flesh looks like the Passover lamb. I'll give you another one. 1 Peter 1:18-19, the New Testament. For you know that it was not with perishable things, such as silver or gold, that you were redeemed from the empty way of life handed down to you from your ancestors, but with the precious blood of Christ, a what? A lamb without blemish or defeat. What is all of Scripture hinting at? Jesus is Passover realized. This is why when Jesus sits with his disciples on the eve of his rest, Luke 22:19, he says, he took bread, gave thanks, and broke it, and gave it to them, saying, this is my body given for you. Do this in remembrance of me. It's the eve of Jesus' arrest, right? He's about to get arrested. He's about to go to the cross, and he gathers his disciples around the table. And do you know what they're doing? They're not just sharing a random meal. They're not just getting together to get together. They're actually participating in the Passover meal on the eve of his arrest. And as they're doing that, as they're sitting around the table and eating together, they're remembering and they're celebrating the first Passover, how God delivered their ancestors from Egypt. And Jesus, in the middle of all of that, this is something that their culture, their families had been participating in for generations. They're doing it again. They're eating the Passover meal. They're celebrating, remembering the first Exodus and the first Passover. And in the midst of all that, Jesus looks at his disciples and he says, listen, every Passover that you've ever celebrated, every Passover that your parents and their parents and their parents have ever celebrated for hundreds of years, all of it has been pointing to me. It's like that moment you're watching a movie and it all clicks together. Do you know what I'm talking about? And everything that came before it starts to make sense. This is that moment in history where all of these things culminate in Jesus. And he says, I am that Passover lamb. And from now on, when you celebrate Passover, I don't want you to just remember the Egyptians. I don't want you to just remember deliverance out of Egypt. Now, when you celebrate the Passover, I want you to think of me. When you take this bread, remember how I have taken you from death. When you drink this wine, remember how my blood was shed so death would pass you over. right? Now watch this. During the Passover festival, that week was very celebratory in Egyptian or in Israelite culture. During the Passover festival in Jesus' time, thousands of lambs would be outsourced to all the local shepherds, right? Just imagine, thousands of lambs are outsourced to the Bethlehem shepherds. But why? Because all the families that were traveling to Jerusalem to celebrate this festival either didn't have lambs of their own, or they couldn't afford to bring their lambs all the way to Jerusalem. And so the temple priest, he would outsource thousands of lambs to be used during this week in Jerusalem for the Passover festival. And these Bethlehem shepherds, they're responsible really for one thing. They had one job. Their job was to raise up perfect lambs without blemish to be used during Passover. That's a hell of a job, right? You have to raise up thousands of lambs without any blemish, without any defect, to be used during the Passover celebration. Now, one of the ways that they did this to ensure that the lambs would be without blemish was that the moment those lambs were born, the moment a lamb was born, you know what they would do? They would take that lamb, they would wrap it in cloth, and they would lay it in a manger. Right? Does that sound familiar? But not only that, when these unblemished lambs were brought back to Jerusalem after they had grown up, when they were getting ready to sacrifice them for the Passover feast, do you know how they were sacrificed? They would take a stake and they would drive it through the lamb from the bottom all the way up. And then they would take another stake and drive it through their sides. And they would hang them out to dry. What did it look like? It looked like someone hanging on a cross. Does that look familiar, right? All of these things, all of these symbols, all of these things without culture, all throughout scripture, all throughout Israel's culture and history, generation after generation, there have been divine hints pointing to the fact that Jesus is the Passover lamb and that he would have to be sacrificed for our salvation. Now, the way that modern-day Jews celebrate the Passover is through something known as the Seder. We used to participate in that as a church, but then I felt a little more dilemma, like, are we cultural appropriating that? I don't know. But we used to do the Seder, but modern-day Jews, they still celebrate the Seder today. Seder is like a ceremonial meal that commemorates Israel's exodus, right, from Egypt, the story that we're talking about. And it all revolves around the Haggadah. I think I'm pronouncing that right. The Haggadah is like their storybook. They open it and they read through the story of the Exodus and as they sit around a meal and remember together. So all night long, they read from the Haggadah as they retell the story of how God delivered their people from Egypt. And at the heart of Seder is the retelling of their story with God. Married couples in the house, I don't know about you, but I love it when someone asks me, hey, can you share your love story, your origin story with Krista? Like something inside me comes alive. I get into narrator mode and I love like embellishing the story and like being excited, enthusiastic about it. I love to share our story because I love that story. It's one of my favorite stories in the world. It's your favorite story too, right, Pastor Krista? Our love story? Of course, right? And I don't know about you, but I look forward to the day. I have this weird fantasy that one day I just imagine Zion and Ezra, my two sons, running up to us like, Amma, Appa, tell us the story again. Tell us the story again. And I imagine when they're doing that and we're getting all together and we're telling, what are we doing? We're retelling. We're also rehearsing our story. Why? Because our love story defines their story, right? But also because the rehearsing of our past stories impacts our future stories. Do you guys know who John Gottman is? They call him the love guru of our generation. They say that he could sit with a couple before they get married and sit with them for 5 minutes and he would be able to determine with an over 50% accuracy whether they're going to get divorced or stay together. It's kind of scary, right? I'm just kidding. I believe we'll sit with them and we'd be fine. But John Gottman, who's one of the modern day leading experts on marriage and relationships, he shares what he believes are the indicators of a healthy relationship or a doomed relationship. And this is what he says. There's one important bit of evidence that can help you assess where you stand. Through my research on couples, I have found that nothing foretells a marriage's future as accurately as how a couple retells their past. The crucial factor is not necessarily the reality of a marriage's early days, but how husband and wife currently view their joint history. I mean, think about that. That's really true. When I interpret my past through the lens that, you know, God left me hanging, that he abandoned me, what happens the next time when I face something difficult? Right? My past story tells me that I can't trust God with my future story. And so when we learn how to retell our love story with God, our future in God is shaped to be stronger. Right? Whenever I retell my love story with Krista, gratitude begins bubbling up on the inside of me. I feel like I'm in love again. Why? Because when we retell our past story, it shapes our future story together. But not only that, rehearsing our past story also shapes our present story. Abraham Heschel, a famous rabbi, he says this about the Exodus. About the arrival of the people at Sinai, we read in the book of Exodus, in the third month after the children of Israel were gone forth out of the land of Egypt, on this day they came into the wilderness of Sinai. Here was an expression that puzzled the ancient rabbis. On this day? It should have said on that day. This can only mean that the day of giving the Torah can never become past. That day is this day, every day. The Torah, whenever we study it, must be to us as if it were given to us today. The same applies to the day of the Exodus from Egypt. In every age, man must see himself as he himself went out of Egypt. What's he saying? He's saying, when I look back to the past story, I look at it as if it wasn't just on that day, but it's on this day. Right? When God delivered me in that season, I know that God will deliver me in this season. What happens when you rehearse God's covenant story? Do you know what you're doing? You're entering into the story again, right? You're stepping into the truth and the reality of that story again. You're keeping the fire of love alive today. How's your walk with God? It's dry. Rehearse the story, right? How's your faith life right now? Rehearse the story. Do you want a strong and vibrant life with God? Rehearse the story over and over and over again. What's your Passover story, right? In what way did you encounter God? How did he become real to you? When did he win your heart? You should know that story, and you should learn how to tell that story well. Right? Sorry to pick on you guys, but imagine going to a couple that's just so in love, like right now, like Steph and Isaiah, right? They're so in love right now. Every time you're around them, you feel the love vibes, right? But if I went to Isaiah and I was like, Isaiah, like when did you know you were in love? How did you know that you fell in love with Steph? And he's like, I don't know. Like, you know the first thing I would do? I would look to Steph dead in her face and I'll be like, run, okay? Dump this guy right now. He should know the story. By the way, Isaiah knows the story, and he loves the story. He's one of the most sweetest boyfriends in the world, right? We should know our love story with God, and we should be able to rehearse it and retell it. Why? Because our present and our future stories depend on it. Now, this brings us to the question that we've been asking every week as we study these ancient festivals. How does the Passover inform how we are to worship God today? Because all the theological theories and stuff, that's really cool and all, but what does this mean? How do I live this in an embodied way? How do I practice worship? Today we learn that every time you retell and rehearse the story of God, you are worshiping. And there are three ways that I want to suggest to you that we can enter into that kind of worship today. The first is to craft your story. I didn't say tell your story or know your story. I said craft your story. Because how many of you guys know, as good as a story is, if it's not crafted well, it's not a good story. How many movies have we seen that might have good scripts but are horrible in execution, right? How you craft the story matters. Another word for story is like your testimony. And the questions are, what is your story with God? How did you encounter him? When did he become real to you? How did he win your heart? How did he show up in your life? And listen, there doesn't have to be like one definitive salvation story. Like, come on, how many of you guys grew up in church? And it's like, what's your testimony? And it's so much pressure to like give this one truncated story that tells your whole story. For many of us, our journey with God is a progression. It's ongoing. It's ever evolving. All our interactions with God, whether big or small, are all vital pieces to our story. I don't know about you, but I used to struggle with this. I had what I like to call testimony envy growing up in the church, right? Like my story, I grew up in a Christian household. I went to a Christian private school. All my family were Christians, right? My story seems so boring compared to that person who overcame a drug addiction and escaped the cartel and had a near-death experience. All true stories, by the way. It's only when I began intentionally retelling and rehearsing my own story that I really began falling in love with it more and more. I began to cherish each moment I shared with God as uniquely our own, right? This is a moment with God. This is a relationship and an interaction with God that he and I share, only him and I share throughout all of history. And I realized that my history with God is unlike anyone else's in all of history and for all of time. And I stopped comparing my story to others. All of a sudden, it's not just the story of the God of Abraham or the God of Moses or the God of David. It's like now I'm in the story of the God of Mickey. Listen, your story with God should be your favorite story. Like, once again, if you came up to me or Krista, you're like, oh, like, can you tell us your love story? And I was like, nah, it's boring. Like, you should go to Tristan and Kristen. Their story is really good, right? If I said that, what would you think? You would think there's something wrong with that. But how do we do this, right? How do we craft a story worth telling? I think there's a few things that we can do. First, we could start by listing every time that God showed up in your life. And it could be big, could be small, could be significant or seemingly insignificant. But listing every meaningful interaction that we've had with him. Maybe he answered a prayer. Maybe he spoke to you. Maybe he healed you. Maybe you felt his presence. Maybe you experienced his love through a friendship. Maybe you're sitting through a sermon and something just clicked, right? Put it all down and then begin to organize it in a creative way. There's two ways that I want to suggest to you that we could craft our stories today. The first is through what's called a life map. Have you guys heard of a life map? If you were at a retreat 2 years ago, we actually did it together. It's a visual representation of your story, whether that's on a timeline by time, or one of my mentors, Pastor Brian, he does it by geographical locations. So he actually has a map, and he's pinned the different places where God's met with him. I think we have a few examples up here. This is not Pastor Krista, by the way. This is just one of the first things that pops up on Google Images. But these are some examples of like a life map that you could do. And I think it's a really cool way. I even noticed, I redid mine just for this sermon, for the next slide. So this is like my updated life map, right? And it's a cool way to just look back on your story and to see every major moment that you had. Hey, don't look too closely at my life map, okay? That's my story. Vulnerable. Just kidding. But the cool, you start to notice these patterns. Like for me, I noticed that while doing this, that almost every major moment or interaction I had with God usually followed like a really dark time in my life. The most recent right here, Joshua Tree, you see it's 2025. Your boy needed some help, man. And this past March, I was in a really low place and Krista sent me on my birthday to go on a personal retreat to Joshua Tree. And I just got to spend a few nights there. I was in the hot tub at night, looking up the stars, smoking a cigar, drinking wine. And it was the perfect vibe. And then the morning I went on a hike to find myself and find God. But the backdrop to that encounter with God was a season of pain, was a season of darkness, was a season of heartbreak, right? When you see the threads of God's faithfulness weave throughout your life, it gives you hope and faith for the days to come. It also recontextualizes the season that you're in now. But the second way I want to suggest, if you don't care to do all that, you're not a graphic designer, you don't know how to draw, forget that. All of you have Spotify or Apple Music. How many Spotify versus Apple Music fans? Spotify, let's just see. Apple Music. Okay. Hey, I'm with you, brother. Dude. Apple Music, man. One of the ways that I was suggested, I've never actually tried this, is to create a mixtape. You guys remember mixtapes? Come on, 80s, 90s babies. We didn't have streaming. We had to create little cassettes or CDs with mixed songs on it, right? One of the ways that you could create your life map or create a story, craft your story, is through a mixtape. You ever hear a song on Spotify come up, right? And you hear it and all of a sudden you're transported to a specific time in your life. The other week, you know what came up? Oops, I did it again. Britney Spears. It transported me. I was a middle school kid again. I remember that time. I remember what I felt. I remember what I experienced. I think it's the same with worship music too, right? There are certain worship songs, when I hear it, they take me back to a season where those lyrics were literally my prayers. Right, there's a song that we used to sing here at 99 called Real Thing that we now sing to Zion and Ezra every night. That used to be the anthem of our early church days as a church plan. I don't know if you remember. It goes, oh, I won't let go. And every time I hear that song, I remember being in a tiny second floor upper room above a picture framing studio with barely any room to move. And I remember us worshiping together as a church community saying, we have done church before all our lives, but we want the real thing. We don't want this to be fake. We don't want this to be religious show. We want the real thing, right? And so create a mixtape of the different songs correlated to the different moments where you interacted with God in your life. They don't all have to be Christian worship songs. They could be whatever song you want. One song that touched me when I was in college was Bruno Mars, Just the Way You Are. And I remember I was driving in hot Davis sun with my AC blasting. When I see your face, I just was moved, right? This is God speaking and singing this to me. Okay. So try making a mixtape of your story with God. So that's the first thing. Craft your story. Number two, sing your songs, okay? Singing songs of worship in the gathering is one of the best ways to retell and rehearse the stories of God. You know, when you sing songs of worship, it reorients you towards him. Do you remember we talked about the purpose of our gathering is orientation, right? It's enthronement. It's memorialization. Every time we sing songs, we reorient our hearts towards God. We enthrone him as king over our lives, and we begin to remember all of the good things that he has done. So often, I find that we're stuck in our own stories, right? Our own stories of discouragement and defeat, our own stories of sadness and pain, our own stories of anxiety and burnout, but when we sing, we're thrust back into God's story, right? It doesn't make our circumstances or our pain any easier. It doesn't make them go away, but it begins to recontextualize them, right? All of a sudden, we're reminded that the story that I'm in right now is not the end of my story. We know which way the story is headed. We know that the story isn't over if the story isn't good. And so these songs that we sing every Sunday, do you know what we were doing earlier today when we were singing those three or four songs before we got into the sermon? Do you know what we were doing? We were reminding ourselves, we were retelling and rehearsing the story of God, right? These are more than just good vibes. These are theology lessons every time that we sing, right? When we sing, we're retelling and rehearsing the story of God together. Right, when we sing, you are good, good, oh, we're rehearsing and retelling the truth of God in our community. And here's the thing. The reason why we do it in community every week, at least once a week, and we don't do it by ourselves in the car or in the shower. You can do that, but the reason why we do it in community is because sometimes it's hard to believe God's story on our own. Do you know what I'm talking about? Have you been there? Right? When I'm in the thick of my struggle, sometimes it's hard to sing, you are good, good, and truly believe it. But if you get in a room with an army of people singing it, all of a sudden, that does something to us. We begin believing it, and we draw on other people's faiths, right? So one of the ways that we could retell and rehearse the story is through singing of our songs. And the last one is through an ancient practice known as communion. There's one practice that we do as a church that captures the retelling and the rehearsing of God's story more than any other. One little act that expresses the entirety of the scriptures. One little thing that we do that it captures the love story between God and man, and it's called communion. When we take the bread and we take the wine, we are actually reliving and retelling the Passover story. Not just the story of the ancient Israelites escaping Egypt, but our own Passover story. That God, the blood Lamb of God, was shed for our freedom and for death to pass over us. That his body was broken to make us whole and healed, right? We don't take communion because we're religious. We take communion because we're rehearsing. We take communion because we're retelling the story. Now, if I had planned this in advance, we would be doing communion today. But I accidentally did it last week, so we're not going to end in communion today. But I want you to keep that in mind. 3 weeks from now, we are going to take communion as a church once a month. I should have just done it anyway. You wouldn't have known. But I'm telling you the truth. And so these three things, I want to encourage you. How do we worship God? Based on the Passover, we retell and we rehearse the story of God. Three ways that you could do that. Craft your story. I feel like some of us, we need to go home this week, and in the midst of our busy week, we need to craft our story. We need to remember, because in this season we're in, we might feel dry, we might feel aimless, we might look at the world and be hopeless. Craft your story. Look at how God's been faithful throughout your life, right? Second, sing your songs. Come every Sunday. Join the saints in the retelling and the rehearsing of God's story. And then 3 weeks from now, come and take communion with us, okay? So just to recap, we've been in this series. We've been looking at all the festivals. Can we go to that chart, Reagan, the last one? With the Festival of Unleavened Bread, we learned that worship is finding, naming, and confessing your sin. With the Feast of Tabernacles, we learn that worship is showing hospitality to the stranger and the vulnerable. We did that this week, guys, when we gave towards that family. With the Feast of Trumpets, we will learn that worship is stopping to recognize God's faithfulness in your life and expressing your gratitude. With the Day of Atonement, we learn that worship is seeking reconciliation through apology and absolution or forgiveness. Last week, we learned that Pentecost is, we learn how worship is seeking to make space to be filled with God's Spirit. Sorry, there's a typo there. And then today, Passover worship is retelling and rehearsing the story of God in our lives. So I want to invite you to a time of response. Why don't we close our eyes for a moment? I think there's an invitation this morning in a very small way. Some of us, we're in the thick of our stories right now. We're in the thick of our stories of disappointment and sorrow. We're in the thick of our stories of confusion and pain. We're in the thick of our stories of anxiety. We're really deep in our own stories right now. But I feel like there's an invitation this morning for us to enter into the story of God again. This is not an escape from our reality. Once again, it's recontextualizing our reality. When we enter into the story of God, it's not burying our head in the sands to the realities of the circumstances we're facing, to the tragedies going on in the world. It's not escaping those things. It's simply recontextualizing them through a different story. There's a story right now that the media is telling. There's a story right now that the culture is telling. There's a story that even our own thoughts are telling. But what we need right now more than anything is to re-enter into God's story. His story is a story in which our story finds meaning and purpose. And so today, this morning, I want to invite you into entering into God's story again. And to do that, I want you to just begin rehearsing and retelling your story with God. You don't have to do the whole thing, but is there one moment where God really showed up in your life? One moment where he was so real, where you knew this was it. This is what I was made for. Is there a moment of your life where it was so undeniably true that God exists and that he loves me? I want you to think of that moment right now. I want you to hold it in your mind, in your heart. And I want you to bring that story into the present. Begin rehearsing and retelling that story in your mind. Remember what it felt like. Remember what he said. Remember what he did. Remember how it made you feel. And begin entering into that story. God, this morning we remember and we recollect the beautiful things that you have done throughout our history. The invisible threads of faith that you have weaved throughout our journey. And this morning, we begin retelling and rehearsing our story with you so that our story from the past can begin shaping our story in the present and our story in the future.